I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Today's Washington Post calls for bolder action and more honest words from President Bush after his speech last night at the Army War College. The New York Times dubbed the president's list of five steps to move Iraq towards sovereignty merely a recitation of the tasks ahead and not the new course he needs to take. But the Chicago Sun-Times headline reads, Bush clearly spells out why we must stay the course to, as the president said, combat terrorists with an agenda.
Our terrorist enemies have a vision that guides and explains all their varied acts of murder. They seek to impose Taliban-like rule, country by country, across the greater Middle East.
President Bush speaking last night. Well, joining us on the line now is Harvard Professor David Gergen, an advisor to Presidents Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Clinton. And David, your thoughts first on the president's linking of the Taliban and terrorists in Iraq.
Well, that's not the first time, of course, the president has done that. I think he tends to put the anybody who's opposing the United States in Iraq into a terrorist category. And, of course, there are terrorists, genuine terrorists, who've come to Iraq. There are people there who were thugs all along. Mm-hmm. I think that what some of the opponents here in the United States look to the president is to acknowledge, yes, there may be terrorists, but there are also there's growing hostility to the American occupation among the Iraqi people in general, and that was not acknowledged in the speech.
Is this an attempt possibly to, you know, obviously it's a sort of a new domino theory, but also reflect on things are going relatively well in Afghanistan, just an attempt to bring that up?
Well, I think that's in part true. It's obviously true that things are getting better in Afghanistan, although they're certainly not the kind of order and stability and there that one would hope, and it's still dangerous in Afghanistan. But I think there's a larger context here, and the president really was trying to say, look, we're at a crossroads. We can go either toward a free and stable Iraq, and that's what we're trying to build, or the other path, the one of that would see a U.S. pulling back or pulling out of Iraq, as some of his political opponents here in the United States would like to do.
Well, as you know,
that would be a disaster from his point of view.
Well, as you know, the president is going to make five speeches in the next 5 weeks leading up to the handover. Supporters say the president laid a good foundation for a future action last night. Critics were disappointed that he didn't offer a mid-course correction. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I think what's very striking to the reaction to the speech are two things. One is that it didn't seem to change many minds. People who were supportive of the president, wanted to see him succeed, thought he was on the right course, came away praising the speech. And of course, they were mostly Republicans. And people who were skeptical and growing pessimistic about events in Iraq, many of whom are now Democrats, were totally unmoved. One saw that same thing in focus groups. CNN had a focus group that Judy Woodruff had. AP had three focus groups. All of those focus groups found that the reaction among the public at large was extremely mixed. But there's one other thing that I think is very important about the speech, and that is in terms of changing public opinion, building the support the president so obviously is hoping to build prior to June 30th, and that was the vast majority of Americans didn't see it. The decision by the networks not to carry the speech.
Well, now, David, we understand that they weren't asked to carry the speech.
Well, they weren't, but it was, you know, clearly the White House wanted them to. They didn't have the president appear in prime time by accident. They did say it was going to be a big major speech. And the negotiations with the networks are sort of a kabuki dance in which the White House says the president is available to give a speech and it's available for coverage, going to be a major national address, and they hope he comes. If they sense that he really has a lot to say, and they're making a terrible decision, then they will sometimes ask. But you never want to ask. You never want to enter a formal request if you think you're going to get turned down. And I think they were in the situation yesterday where the networks really did not think that there was much that was newsworthy in the speech. And besides, they had some very good, popular programming, entertainment program they wanted to go with. I think it made a dramatic difference in the impact of the speech. It just didn't have that much of an impact because it wasn't seen by very many people.
Well, David, thank you so much for your thoughts on it for those who didn't see it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
David Gergen, an advisor to four presidents. He currently teaches at the Center for Leadership at the JFK School of Government at Harvard University.
Democratic presidential candidate John Kerry is in Oregon today promoting his energy plan as gasoline prices soar around the country. His reaction to President Bush's speech last night was a call for the president to turn his words into action and ask for help so that the U.S. doesn't have to go it alone. Well, former Secretary of the Navy John Dalton, now a Kerry campaign advisor, joins us on the line. Welcome, and tell us, what would Kerry do in Iraq on June 30th if he were president now?
Well, I think it's very important that we reach out and seek the help of our allies and friends. The president mentioned that he was going to try to do that last night. I think John Kerry would have made a major attempt to do that from the outset. He said that on the floor of the Senate some 600 days ago. Now, the president did say last night that he was going to make, that was one of his five-point plans, and I think that is good news. The unfortunate thing is that because of the way that we went into this without having the support of our major allies, people like Germany and France, it is going to be more difficult now since we sort of thumbed our nose at them going in.
And why does Senator Kerry think that he would get a different reception from Europe and from other allies around the world?
He understands the importance of dealing with world leaders, and he has not had a policy of going it alone.
I wonder if you could also help us understand why Senator Kerry has been so quiet, almost muted in his criticism. We've heard a lot from Senator Biden and from Senator McCain and a lot of the other members of the Senate about Iraq who have great concerns there.
Well, you're going to hear an awful lot from Senator Kerry starting this week, as a matter of fact. He's going to be laying out his plans for foreign policy dealing with Iraq and Afghanistan, but also a comprehensive foreign policy strategy that our country needs.
Let's fast forward for a moment, if we can, to January of 2005.
Okay.
Let's say that Senator Kerry has been elected president, that conditions on the ground in Iraq are pretty much the same as they are now. What would you advise him to do?
The kind of plan that we're going to be hearing about over the next few weeks is, in fact, what he would implement. But clearly, it involves working with our allies. So I think any kind of major international conflict, the American people have to understand what the strategy is. And if they do understand it, they will support it. But I don't think that they have understood what we were trying to do here, and I still think it's blurred.
Well, what about specifically sending in more troops?
I think it was clear to everyone that we needed more troops to start with. That was made clear by the chief of staff of the Army, General Shinseki. What the level will need to be 6-8 months from now, it's hard to say.
I know we've been asking you to speak for the last few minutes as a surrogate for Senator Kerry. I'm curious as well what your reaction has been as a military man, as the former naval secretary over the past year, in seeing how the U.S. has performed in Iraq in a post-war situation.
This was an ill-conceived operation from the get-go, and it was not something we needed to do. We certainly could have contained Saddam Hussein with the no-fly zones, with the intercept operation, maritime interceptor operations, and with the inspections. This was not something we needed to do, but we have done it. We are now there. And to answer your question specifically, it has been disappointing. And I don't think our troops knew what they were supposed to do.
Mr. Secretary, thank you.
Thank you, Gail.
John Dalton is a former Secretary of the Navy, now a Kerry campaign advisor. One story that has been quietly making the rounds after last week's raid on the home of Ahmed Chalabi is whether Iran helped manipulate the U.S. into war by passing on bogus intelligence through the INC, Chalabi's Iraqi National Congress. Those whispers became a shout today in the U.K.'s Guardian newspaper. Joining us on the line is The Guardian's Julian Borger, who wrote that story. Welcome, Julian.
Thank you.
The headline on your story reads, U.S. intelligence fears Iran duped hawks into Iraq war, which certainly is a grabber for an American audience.
Yes. I mean, what this is about is that the CIA is now confident that it has hard evidence that Ahmed Chalabi passed secret U.S. information to the Iranian intelligence, and his right-hand man, Aras Karim Habib, is a paid agent of Iranian intelligence. And what that has done is set alarm bells ringing, because Ahmed Chalabi and Aras Karim Habib were some of the primary channels which some of the bad intelligence that led up to the Iraq war on Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction, it went through their hands.
Well, and to what end? What was Iran trying to accomplish here?
Well, you can only speculate that this regime in Iraq, Saddam Hussein, was their number one enemy, their most immediate enemy, their neighbor sitting on their border. What the U.S. invasion did, of course, was to get rid of him and leave a situation in which a Shia majority in Iraq is poised to become the dominant force in a new Iraq. And obviously that would make them natural allies with the Shia Republic of Iran.
You also quote Larry Johnson, a former senior counterterrorist official at the State Department, who said that Iran has run one of the most masterful intelligence operations in history. Was it that masterful, or were they speaking to people that they knew would want to hear this information?
Well, maybe that's the masterful thing about it, is that they told people, certain people, certain hawks in the Pentagon, but particularly what they wanted to hear, and reinforced an inclination that was already there. There is some suggestion, you know, that the Iranians were there at the very beginning of the INC. They're sort of joint masters or patrons along with the U.S. The Americans were aware of this, and the Britons were aware of this, that there was this relationship with Iran. In the mid-90s, the CIA and British intelligence really pretty much disowned Chalabi, and a notice was put out in general in U.S. intelligence saying, you know, don't trust this man. But then you come to the 2000 election, and a number of leading neoconservative hawks get into positions of considerable influence, and Chalabi is back because he reinforces this sense that Iraq is really the big problem, the big danger.
Well, as you know, the U.S. intelligence community hasn't liked Chalabi for years. Are you concerned that they seem to be the chief source of this kind of information?
I mean, yes. There obviously is been this long-running battle, but that view is shared by many others, and borne out, of course, by events. There aren't any weapons of mass destruction there. The evidence for the weapons of mass destruction was, to a great degree, defectors provided, supplied by the INC. So really, the burden of proof is now very much with the INC and Ahmed Chalabi, because what they said would be there and promised would be there isn't there.
If it turns out that, in fact, it was Iran that in some way manipulated the U.S. into going to war in Iraq through bogus intelligence, how explosive is this in the U.K. as well as the U.S.?
Very explosive, obviously. I mean, in a way, the bomb has already gone off in Britain in terms of the profound public disillusion with the reasons for going to war. I don't think that bomb has gone off in terms of public perceptions of the war here. But if there was an Iranian role in it, and Iran is still portrayed as a member of the Axis of Evil, and the invasion has played into Iran's hands, then you can imagine that there will be a shift of opinion about the invasion and whether it was worthwhile.
Julian, thank you.
Thanks.
Julian Borger is Washington Bureau Chief for The Guardian newspaper.
Just ahead, living downwind. The toxic effects of air pollution are being passed to the next generation.
And later in the program, the mysterious rise in male breast cancer and
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
Scientists have known for some time that industrial pollution can cause genetic damage, mutations that are passed on to subsequent generations, at least in mice. Well, now, for the first time, in a paper published in the journal Science, those mutations have been linked to something specific in the air, soot. Dr. Jim Quinn and his colleagues at McMaster University in Hamilton, Canada, discovered this effect by placing mice in cages downwind of a steel mill. Mice in cages nearby who breathed filtered air had far less DNA damage. And Dr. Quinn joins us now to explain those results. Welcome.
Thanks very much, Gail.
Now tell us, in your research, you had some mice breathing downwind of a steel mill, the others, as we just said, breathing filtered air. So what was it you were filtering out?
We were filtering out particulate, that is the breathable little particles that are in the air pollution. Some people call them soot. So they're very tiny particles. They're particles that easily get down into your lungs and can deliver various chemicals that can be taken up in your bloodstream.
And is it the soot itself that's the problem, or is it the other chemical contaminants that stick to the soot?
It is likely to be a combination. Soot itself can cause some harm, although it's not as great as the chemicals that are attached to the soot. The contaminants that attach to the soot include a whole family of chemicals called polycyclic aromatic compounds, and these include benzoapyrene, which is thought to be the most important cancer-causing agent in tobacco smoke. So there are a number of these types of chemicals that bind to the breathable particulate that then can be delivered to the lungs via this soot.
And where do these particles come from?
These particles come primarily from coking ovens and steel mills, diesel trucks. They also include these coal-fired power stations.
And so what did your research tell us that we really didn't know before?
Well, the first step of our research, which was published several years ago, showed that there's a link between germline mutations in herring gulls and the location that the colony is in. Following that, we showed that mice breathing the polluted air have these elevated germline mutation rates, which is a change in DNA that's passed on to their pups through their sperm.
And the damage was what, 2 times greater?
The increase in rate of mutation passed on to the next generation was 2-fold increased, that's right. And then this latest study showed that when you filter out the particulate, that effect goes away. That is, even when you're looking at mice raised in polluted areas, if the air is filtered, then the rate of mutations is the same as that on a rural site where the mice are breathing unfiltered air.
Is there a clear link between this kind of damage and actually developing disease?
There is no clear link between this kind of damage and developing damage. It's the bottom line, though, is that it is easier to detect DNA changes using the type of DNA that we have studied as opposed to the type of DNA that would be directly related to these genetic diseases.
So tell us more about what this means for us as people. Clearly we can sidestep steel mills, I guess, but what other implications does this research have for us?
Well, I think we can look at it in a number of ways. We can look at it in terms of our own daily lives, in which case if you're living near a steel mill, near highways, busy highways, that sort of location, you might choose to have a HEPA filtration unit in your house. And I think one of the important aspects of this finding is that knowing that the particulate is primarily responsible puts us in a position to perhaps do something about it. So we have some proactive steps that potentially can be taken to reduce the likelihood of this kind of an effect and also other effects that are known to be associated with these particles. For instance, lung cancer we know can be caused by these particles. Asthma is also associated with particulate air pollution. At a sort of medium scale, when you think about the fact that leaves actually filter some of these particulate, you might think about not building roads, not cutting down trees, in fact, planting trees. You could consider things on a more global basis, trying to reduce our dependence upon petroleum products. These diesel trucks are a real problem, introducing this kind of particulate air pollution.
Well, and it certainly sounds sobering enough that we ought to be paying attention.
I think so. And I think the way to view it is to think of it as a canary in a coal mine. And when the canary drops dead, then you should be thinking very seriously about getting out of the mine or doing something about the air that's coming towards you.
Hmm. Dr. Quinn, thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks very much for having me.
Dr. Jim Quinn is a biologist at McMaster University in Hamilton, Canada. His study is published in the journal Science. Everything gets blamed on genetics these days, and that now extends to unruly hair. Scientists at Johns Hopkins University and the Howard Hughes Medical Institute have now identified a gene that controls the hair whorls and patterning in mice.
Called Frizzled 6, the gene is one of a family of genes that occur in all mammals and have also been shown to control wing hair and bristle growth in fruit flies. The gene is active in hair follicles and skin cells, but its effects may be more than skin deep. Recent research in people links the direction of hair swirls on the scalp with the tendency toward left or right-handedness. Now, an important question in biology has always been, how does an embryo, which starts out completely symmetrical, transform into a fully developed organism, but one that has a left and a right hand, a heart only on the left side, and an asymmetrical brain? If Frizzled 6 is part of the picture, then it may well influence how that brain is organized. So finally, we understand the cowlick and the Frizzled 6. Now, if someone could just explain to us the frizzies, the flyaway hair, and split ends.
Gimme head with hair, long, beautiful hair, shining, gleaming, steaming, flaxen, waxen. Gimme down the there, hair, shoulder length or longer, here, baby, there, mama, everywhere, daddy, daddy, hair.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, former New York Times restaurant critic Mimi Sheridan reflects on a life of eating out. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and Now. I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Wall Street has been holding its breath since word spread last January that New York Attorney General Eliot Spitzer was investigating the huge pay package earned by the ousted chairman of the New York Stock Exchange. Well, yesterday, Wall Street exhaled. Rather than go after most of the board members who signed off on the chairman's salary, Spitzer sued former Stock Exchange head Richard Grasso, demanding he return more than $100 million of his pay. Adding to the intrigue, the two men are former friends. And in an op-ed in today's Wall Street Journal, Grasso was defiant, saying he looks forward to his day in court. Well, joining us on the line is Suzanne Craig, a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Suzanne, what does Spitzer say that Grasso did?
He's saying that he manipulated the pay process through various means, whether it was lack of disclosure or through favor and influence at the New York Stock Exchange in order to get this type of pay.
How does that work? Because this is a board of highly educated, very successful people. So what would he do to manipulate?
Well, Mr. Spitzer's alleged that on some cases he simply didn't show the board and the compensation committee all the information. And then on other areas, it becomes pretty tricky. Mr. Grasso, in addition to being head of the New York Stock Exchange, he is a regulator. He regulates firms like Morgan Stanley and Credit Suisse First Boston, and these firms also happen to sit on the compensation committee, so there's allegation of favor as well.
Well, and intimidation. Apparently one source is saying that he questioned Mr. Grasso's deal, and he was later confronted by Dick Grasso, and then his thinking was, well, gee, he's my supervisor, my regulator, I better vote for him.
Yeah, definitely. The allegation that Mr. Spitzer has made is that Mr. Grasso ruled the big board with an iron fist and that he knew everything that was going on. And in fact, when people would complain not to Mr. Grasso but to others, it would immediately get back to Mr. Grasso.
Well, and in his commentary today in your paper, DiGrasso is saying, I did nothing wrong. I didn't set my compensation. Six different compensation committees did. Further, Elliot Spitzer is running hard for governor, and that he offered to give all of the monies to charity if there was just a simple statement saying that he had done nothing wrong. How is he sounding?
Well, this is for him definitely a reputational issue. He believes he did nothing wrong. You know, before he resigned from the big board, I think he said, thank you, God, I am blessed. Whenever the compensation committees would give him whatever money it was, that was his response. He had nothing to do with it. He was simply thankful. Now his reputation, he believes, has been dragged through the mud, and he's saying by a guy who has great political ambition and simply wants another trophy on his wall.
Well, Suzanne, in addition to this being a story about two former friends, it's also about CEO pay. That's a lot of money. I mean, are people looking at each other nervously and saying maybe we can't do this anymore?
Well, I think what it's done on a broader level has sort of thrown a spotlight on compensation and what's okay and what's not. I think you look at the New York Stock Exchange, it is a not-for-profit organization where somebody was making $30 million a year in one of his better years. I think it's just sort of, it's made us all sort of step back and look and just, again, said, what is acceptable? I mean, these pay packages came at the height of a bull market, but is that an excuse? And I think that's a great question that compensation committees across the country should be answering.
And you write that other Wall Street execs dodged a bullet on this. Just briefly, how so?
They did. I mean, there was speculation that Mr. Spitzer would be looking at going after each of the board members who had a role in setting his pay. He decided yesterday that, in fact, he would go after the people who he believes misled rather than the ones that were misled. And it was, and some say a political decision. His political allies are some of the ones that he didn't decide to charge in this suit.
Hmm. Suzanne Craig, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
The intrigue continues. Suzanne Craig, reporter for The Wall Street Journal.
A study released this week by the American Cancer Society shows that breast cancer in men is increasing, although the disease is still rare in men. Just over 1 in 100,000 are affected. Joining us on the line is lead author of that study, Dr. Sharon Giordano, an oncologist and assistant professor of medicine at the University of Texas in Houston. Welcome, doctor.
Oh, thanks for having me.
First of all, do we know why the number of cases among men is increasing?
I think that's really an unanswered question. We've seen over the same time period that breast cancer in women has been going up also, and the reasons for both of these increases are really unclear. A lot of people have had different hypotheses for why they might be going up. I've heard it suggested that the increasing rates of obesity could relate to it. I've also heard it proposed that estrogens in the environment formed by chemicals or pesticides could contribute to it. But these are only hypotheses, and these have not been proven.
Well, it is something of a mystery, isn't it? Because for women, mammography and use of hormones were believed to be some of the traditional reasons for the increase in breast cancer among women. So it must be puzzling for men.
Right. We really don't know why it's going up in men.
Is it going up in men as much as it has been increasing in women?
No. Over the time period of our study, which was the early 70s through the late 1990s, we saw an approximate 25% increase in men. Over the same time period, we saw roughly a 50% increase in women. So it definitely has not gone up as much as it has in women.
And how does it manifest differently in men? They are older, for one thing, when they're diagnosed?
They tend to be about 5 years older at diagnosis on average, and there are very few men in the youngest age groups. We're seeing, unfortunately, a lot of women in their 30s and early 40s with breast cancer. In men, it's very rare before the age of 40 or 45.
When men are diagnosed with breast cancer, is the disease advanced, or are you able to catch it pretty early on?
Well, we are seeing that men are diagnosed at a more advanced stage disease compared to women. Some of this is probably related to the fact that women are having mammograms. So a lot of women are being diagnosed with disease before it becomes clinically apparent. But we're also seeing higher rates of lymph node spread and even metastatic disease at diagnosis. And I suspect that that might be related to a lack of awareness about the disease.
And
most men really don't believe that they're at risk for developing breast cancer, and certainly most of my male patients have been shocked that they have breast cancer.
I can imagine. And does it begin the same way? I mean, is it usually as a lump?
Yeah, most people present with a lump under one of their nipples. Some men have had bleeding from their nipple or nipple discharge or kind of scaling of the skin that might also be a warning sign.
What is the treatment for men with breast cancer?
It tends to be pretty similar to the treatment for women. The surgery is a little bit different. It's unusual that we do a lumpectomy in men because there's not as much breast tissue that we're trying to save. So most men have a mastectomy. The chemotherapy we use is the same chemotherapy treatments that we use in women. Radiation treatments are generally similar. Hormonal treatments are a little bit different.
How much attention do you think men should be paying to the risk of developing breast cancer?
I think they're certainly reasonable to be more focused on heart disease, prostate cancer, colon cancer, lung cancer. I mean, these are much more common conditions in men. And even though we've seen a rise in breast cancer in men, it still does remain a rare disease. So I don't want to be alarmist that, oh, it's on the rise and everybody's going to get it. It's still very rare.
Is there anything in particular that men can do to avoid it?
I think without understanding better what's causing it, it's hard to know what to avoid to prevent it.
Doctor, thank you.
No problem.
Dr. Sharon Giordano is an oncologist and assistant professor of medicine at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston.
Still to come, the life of an independent filmmaker. Getting the film made is one thing. Finding someone to distribute it, that's another.
You're listening to Here and Now.
This year's National Trust for Historic Preservation's list of endangered historic sites in the U.S. includes the resting place of the racehorse Seabiscuit, the Bethlehem Steelworks plant, and the entire state of Vermont. The trust president says he made the designation to prevent Walmart from opening supercenters in the Green Mountain State. Vermont is the first state to get on the list, but it's not the first time it's received this designation. In 1993, Vermont was the only state that didn't have a Walmart. It then got on the list and persuaded Walmart to open smaller outlets in abandoned buildings, such as old Woolworths and failed Kmarts. Well, now the shopping empire again plans to build its trademark big box stores in Vermont. And joining us on the line is Paul Bruin, Executive Director of the Preservation Trust of Vermont. Paul, what's your concern?
We are very concerned about both protecting and using our historic resources, our downtowns and community centers, and not spoiling the landscape.
Because the number one industry is tourism.
Well, and it's also, there's a special magic about this place. Most of us live here because we love living here. Not because we can make more money than we could somewhere else. There's a special character to this place. There's a wonderful sense of community that we have that I think is missing in a lot of other places around the country.
Well, critics of Walmart say that it immediately endangers downtown areas because all the small stores have to close. But as you know, Walmart is now planning superstores, and Walmart spokespeople say that they provide jobs. And further, there are some who say that the Walmart store in Rutland and in other small, formerly dead buildings isn't doing as well as Walmart likes to do.
Well, they give a mixed message. Some of the press coverage today include comments from Walmart saying that they think that their downtown Rutland store is doing very, very well. What we're looking for here is trying to find a compromise that will enable customers, consumers, to have access to Walmart and other big boxes, but to do it in a way that is sensitive to the Vermont scale and Vermont communities, and do it in a way that we can maintain a healthy, locally owned economy, too.
In other words, you're looking for them to move into dead buildings in the downtown, revitalize the downtown instead of destroying it.
Absolutely.
Right. But as you all know, my cousins up in Vermont hate the idea of huge superstores, but many Vermonters want to be able to do one-stop shopping. They're tired of ordering from their catalogs in the winter, and they want a Walmart.
Well, and it's hard in a lot of communities. Up in northern Vermont, for example, several communities lost an Ames, their Ames store, and that was where they could buy basic goods close to home inexpensively. And we understand that need, and that's why we're suggesting that one solution is a downsized Walmart, a smaller-scale Walmart located in our downtowns.
Yeah. Do you think that you're going to be able to keep superstores out of your state forever?
I don't know. I think that there is a large concern here in Vermont. I think that people are interested in having basic goods, places to get basic goods inexpensively. On the other hand, I think that they are very concerned about the impact that these stores will have. In St. Albans, for example, where one is planned, it won't be just the Walmart. Walmart will be a magnet for the Home Depots of the world, or a Lowe's, or Circuit City. And all of a sudden, it will become big box city in St. Albans, and that will undermine their very strong locally owned economy.
Mm. Well, Paul Bruhn, thank you very much.
Okay, you're welcome.
Paul Bruhn, Executive Director of the Preservation Trust of Vermont.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
This past weekend, Michael Moore's documentary Fahrenheit 9/11 won the coveted Palme d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival, a coup that will guarantee the film even more press and exposure, and if it can settle some contract issues, get it an American distributor. Well, most filmmakers aren't so lucky. Every year, there are hundreds of smaller festivals away from the media glare, attended by independent filmmakers looking to peddle their wares. What kind of shot do they have? Here Now's Andrea Shea went to the Somerville Theater in Massachusetts on the first day of the Boston Independent Film Festival to find out.
Okay, do you want me to bring this one down?
I'll come up and meet you. Do you need help moving that print right now?
I got it moved.
The Independent Film Festival of Boston is only 2 years old, but things appear to be running smoothly for the 20 and 30-somethings who founded the four-day event. Armed with walkie-talkies, they buzz around the registration table, handing out screening passes, fielding questions, and welcoming travel-weary filmmakers such as Todd Pottinger.
You know, film festivals are ultimately promotion and trying to get it distributed, because that's what it's all about, really.
Pottinger spent thousands of his own dollars and 11 years making his documentary Big City Dick, Richard Peterson's first movie. Now he wants audiences to experience this well-known Seattle character.
I think what it is that every city has their character. Everyone has their eccentric person, no matter which city you're in, or perhaps New York has maybe a surplus of them, but he's such an imposing figure and can be very loud and scary, but yet when you start digging deeper and start trying to tell the story of someone, you realize that there's oftentimes so much more there than you ever imagined.
I'm Richard Peterson. I was born in San Diego in 1948, moved up to Southwest Washington immediately. I grew up on Norman Road, southeast of Chehalis, Centralia, in the forest, back in what I call the background music era of the late 50s, early 60s.
Richard Peterson, a fast-talking savant, is Seattle's most famous street musician. In the late 70s, Todd Pottinger came out of a rock concert and saw the tall, lumbering trumpeter surrounded by kids who were pelting him with pennies. But it wasn't the children's cruelty that fascinated the future filmmaker. It was Peterson's reaction. Without a hint of shame, he scrambled and scooped the coins into his personalized plastic bucket. The seed for the film Big City Dick was planted, and years later, in 1993, Pottinger started filming the odd music man with the checkered smile.
I did not do the street yesterday because of heavy rain. And today I just couldn't afford to miss the football crowd.
Start playing!
Pottinger shadowed Peterson on and off for years and discovered a man of many talents and obsessions. He's a skilled pianist and is fascinated with broadcast celebrities, rubber balls, urban architecture, and Johnny Mathis. And like many savants, Peterson has a catalog-like mind. He remembers every note of the theme music from early television shows produced by Ziv, the company that brought viewers the Cisco Kid, Highway Patrol, and Sea Hunt.
Sea Hunt was the greatest Ziv show of all time with that music.
Well, that music inspired Richard Peterson to compose and record his own. Soon, Richard developed an unlikely following in Seattle's grunge scene and got his big break when the Stone Temple Pilots included a song from his second album as a secret ghost track on their multi-platinum release, Purple.
The second album, 12 precious melodies worth listening. Hope you enjoy them, like if it's fun too.
6 years after Todd started filming, two other aspiring filmmakers fell under Richard's spell. Scott Millam and Ken Harder contacted Pottinger, and the three collaborated to complete the film. Now they're trying to make the sale. Why not? Big City Dick won the Audience Award at this year's Slam Dance Film Festival. Anything's possible.
Any independent filmmaker in our position is ultimately looking for distribution, looking for that right person at the right time, so that we can try and sell it to make this worth it, because it's been 11 years in the making.
So do you think that you'll actually get distribution perhaps by being here, or is it more complex than that?
I think all the stories that we've heard, it can be really fluky. It just depends on who sees it. Better Luck Tomorrow happened to be launched by the fact that Roger Ebert was sitting in the audience when there was this row going on, controversy about the film. I mean, that's a real sort of classic tale of how right place, right time. But, you know, we're pretty confident that we have a film that's really unique and really sensitive and is just a great story that we're just hoping that the right person sees it.
Todd Pottinger's not alone. Festival director Adam Rothman also has high hopes.
Out of the 48 films we're showing, I'd say approximately six have distribution, which works in the non-distributed film's favor because the distributors for those six films are here at the festival, and so they're seeing a number of these films that don't have distribution.
So it's distributor bait.
Yeah, sort of. But also very good films. I wouldn't program them if I didn't think they were very strong films.
But then there's Sarah Eaton, a film industry veteran who now works for the Sundance Channel. She says it doesn't look good for Big City Dick or the other films seeking distribution this weekend.
I think it's unlikely. I mean, even a festival like South by Southwest in Austin, I think most of the films that are there have been seen at other larger film festivals, whether it's, you know, Berlin or Sundance or Rotterdam. That being said, there's always the outside chance of making a discovery somewhere, and I'm sure that the people that program the Independent Film Festival of Boston hope that they have the ability to make that discovery, and that, you know, that would be a very exciting thing if somebody spotted something here.
So, folks, we thank you for coming out tonight. We raise our glass to all the filmmakers again that so graciously brought their films out to us. We hope to see you all next year. Cheers, everyone. And I hear the bars are open for another 2 minutes, so go. Good night.
That's it.
In the end, nothing concrete transpired for Big City Dick at the Independent Film Festival of Boston, but Todd Pottinger and his co-directors haven't given up. From Boston, they flew to Baltimore, then on to San Francisco. They've had meetings, received some maybes, and a bunch of flat-out no's. Nobody's buying, but Todd says he'll keep selling.
Yeah, you have to. You have to. I mean, we have no big PR firm behind us. It's just the three of us, and it's difficult as an independent filmmaker, but that's why we all do it. It's worth it, you know. It's worth it. You're doing something you love and supporting something that you've worked really hard to make. And ultimately, also, we want Richard to benefit out of this as well. So we're just hoping a lot more people get to know who he is, the amazing person he is.
Big City Dick, Richard Peterson's first movie, will enjoy a homecoming of sorts next week at the Seattle International Film Festival. Richard plans to sell his CDs outside and will watch what he calls my movie with his entourage of friends and supporters. And who knows, maybe a future distributor will be in the audience as well. Here and Now producer Andrea Shea. For more information on Big City Dick, Richard Peterson's first movie, go to our website, here-now.org. By the way, this song is The Metro Tunnel from Richard Peterson's fourth album, The William Luce Songbook.
In New York City or in Chicago, where those big men sing on a caboose.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Cockle, Karen Miller-Medson, Lindsay Crudell, Emiko Tamagawa, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna.
Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Mike Toda and Ian Hughes. Our web producer is Zach Christo, and our intern is Nick Weiss-Richmond.
The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.